type. Now, that obviously, when you've heard this article, you'll realize that you've heard or seen 5 or 10 other stories of this type. We picked this one out just because a couple of details dovetail interestingly with some other things that we're talking about. But I'm sure any one of the listeners with any experience of this, and certainly we ourselves, could name 5 or 10 other similar occurrences and similar sets of circumstances. Anyway, this first article is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Saturday, March 17th, 1984. It's headlined, Incident Near White House, Gunman's Bizarre Claims. Dateline, Washington. The man who was shot Thursday outside the White House fence when he threatened a guard was ordered yesterday to undergo psychiatric testing after he disrupted a hearing with claims that President Reagan, the FBI, CIA, and Air Force Intelligence Agency had drugged him. During his 35-minute appearance before a U.S. magistrate, David A. Mahonsky, age 25, disrupted his arraignment 3 times. Quote, the President of the United States and certain elements of the society fill me with drugs and ruin my life like the communists would, said Mahonsky, who was dressed in a blue hospital jumpsuit, his right arm in a sling. Mahonsky was shot in the arm Thursday night when he threatened a guard trying to question him. Mahonsky said at the hearing yesterday that the government intelligence agencies, quote, have put a bug in my head which transmits everything I think across the country. I don't need another nut ward. The president has had me in 3 already, unquote. Magistrate Arthur L. Burnett ordered Mahonsky sent for testing to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, the federal mental institution in southeast Washington, and ordered another hearing within 30 days. John Hinckley, Jr., who shot Reagan 3 years ago and was found not guilty in the case by reason of insanity, also is held at St. Elizabeth's. Okay, now, as mentioned, we've had several other articles of this type. We've read several others on our other shows here. As we will see, one of the things that's interesting about this is how some of the details of this supposedly mentally disturbed young man's story dovetail with some other things that we've seen quite a bit of, and we're going to start to find out about some of those things right now.
Okay, now, the following article, research credit for it, goes to Mr. Ted Rubenstein, who's been working with us for some time on this station. Okay. The following story is from the Miami Herald of Monday, May 28, 1984. Now keep in mind Mr. Mahonsky and his strange account there and see if this doesn't sound similar and if it doesn't provide a little more insight on just how somebody might be able to transmit thoughts to or from somebody else. Again, from Miami Herald, Monday, May 28, 1984. This is by a man named Al Messerschmidt, a Miami Herald staff writer. It's headlined, Drug pilot says he's caught in a CIA plot. Subtitled, Implants Called Part of Plan to Control World. James Pettit, P-E-T-T-I-T, convicted drug pilot, admitted arms smuggler, has told the same story over and over again. Nobody believes him. Embedded in his neck, he says, are tiny electronic devices put there by the CIA to control his thoughts. A federal judge heard the tale and ordered a psychiatric examination. The psychiatrist said Pettit is legally competent. The judge ordered a CAT scan, a sophisticated X-ray of Pettit's neck. The test found nothing. When a Dade Circuit judge heard the story, he thought Pettit was trying to talk his way out of an arson charge. The judge ordered new X-rays when Pettit offered to accept a 30-year jail sentence if they turned up nothing. To the surprise of the judge, the prosecutor, and even Pettit's attorney, the newest tests from Jackson Memorial Hospital show 2 foreign objects, unquote, in Pettit's neck. Circuit Judge Howard Gross has ordered exploratory surgery to find out what they are. Thoughts that don't belong to me keep appearing, Pettit said during an interview in the Dade County Jail. The only problem I'm having is getting the implants exposed. Up until the newest X-rays, there was nothing to give credence to his story, unquote, said Pettit's latest attorney, Roy Gelber. I feel that now there is some objective proof of what he is saying. It is the kind of tale that would become a that could become a bestseller, a spy thriller with drug smugglers' airplanes crashing in flames, organized crime, murders, and mind control by the CIA. Sitting in a tiny interview room in the jail, Pettit holds up 1, then 2 X-rays. Each is about the size of a sheet of typing paper. See the circled areas, he says? See that thing that looks like a little bottle? That, my friend, is an implant. They're not metal, they're quartz. They're like tiny radio receivers. I think they were going to use me in a program to assassinate someone, Pettit says. I can't prove the CIA put them in there, but there is no way any other government agency has the power to do that. You think about it. I can't be the only one implanted, unquote. Physically, James Pettit, 39, is a wreck. Burnham Pettit was what federal drug agents called him because of the many planes he crashed during his brief career as a drug pilot. Pettit's latest crash, in April of 1982, a Lockheed Lodestar carrying Quaaludes, was the worst. When the plane exploded in a Colombian pasture, Pettit was burned over 54% of his body. 8 days later, he was admitted to the Burn Center of the U.S. Army Institute of Surgical Research at the Brooke Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. Hospital spokesman Ray Deary, D-E-R-Y, confirmed that Pettit was treated by two doctors at the center until July 2, 1982. Pettit said that while he was at the burn center, the implants were put in his neck, face, arms, and ears. The CIA program was called Operation Crystal Ball, Pettit says, and he found top secret documents on it in a Key West dumpster in the mid-1960s. They came from a safety deposit box that was broken into at the former Key West National Bank, he says. The documents described a CIA plan to take over the world's judicial and political systems through mind control by the year 2000, Pettit says. The crystal ball routine, I'll never be able to prove, he says. But his discovery of the documents is one reason the CIA focused on him, Pettit says. The other reason was his search to find out why his older brother, Herschel Neal Pettit, died in the Gulf of Mexico in 1978. Pettit says his brother was a straight arrow, unquote, and he couldn't believe reports that the elder Pettit had committed suicide aboard a boat loaded with pot. I think he was working for the CIA or the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, Pettit says. I went to New Orleans. I talked to an organized crime family. I gave them a list of names. CIA, 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 don't fool with it, they told me. I put it all together in my head, smuggling, CIA connected. James Pettit is obsessed by thoughts that the CIA can control him. In a deposition, Pettit asked his ex-attorney in federal court, Kathy Hamilton, if she was working for the agency. No, she said, but the CIA once offered her a job as she was graduating from college. Pettit says Hamilton's fidgeting with her hair and with cigarettes were triggering mechanisms, unquote, to control his mind. In motions filed in court, Pettit says his former attorney, assistant public defender James Webb, once showed up in court wearing a Duke University ring. The year on the ring wasn't the year of Webb's graduation, a tip-off that Webb was working for the CIA, says Pettit. I accused him of it. Webb says there's no truth to the accusation. The federal jury that convicted him of drug smuggling in 1983 was controlled by the CIA, says Pettit. Defense attorney Hamilton is convinced that Pettit is linked to the agency. I'll tell you this, she says, Jim Pettit has worked for the CIA. That has been confirmed. Pettit has told me he worked for the CIA. In addition, Charles Marty has told me he worked for the CIA, that he has had Pettit checked out, that it was confirmed. Marty, a co-defendant in the federal drug case, was to have been a co-pilot on a drug flight with Pettit. In the middle of that trial, Marty's defense attorney, Alexander Martoni, asked for a hearing out of the presence of the jurors because he had learned that Marty had met secretly with the DEA and the CIA. The CIA tried to get the charges dismissed because of the CIA connection with my client, Martoni told U.S. District Judge Jose Gonzalez. There are letters in their files. I have direct confirmation that Jim Pettit has flown for the CIA, said Martoni. Jim Pettit needs some definite help. The government owes him that. He's been impaired as a result of those flights. The U.S. government has never taken responsibility for what happened to Jim Pettit. Before Pettit's federal trial, defense attorney Hamilton asked Gonzalez to order a psychiatric test and a CAT scan of Pettit's head. Dr. Charles Mutter, M-U-T-T-E-R, or Mutter, reported that Pettit was competent to stand trial and added, quote, It is my opinion that this individual is attempting to contrive a story to evade further legal proceedings. Although his alleged belief would represent a psychotic delusion, there is nothing else in the mental status exam that is consistent with mental illness, unquote. The CAT scan at Jackson Memorial found nothing. Pettit didn't testify. He refused to cooperate with Hamilton. The attorney said nothing about the CIA or implants. The jury convicted Pettit. Gonzalez ordered a 15-year prison term. A 15-year prison sentence, one of the stiffest in the Operation Screamer cases. Pettit's extensive criminal record, he has served several prison terms, prompted the judge to order the tough sentence, Hamilton says. Now Pettit awaits trial in circuit court, accused of setting fire to his girlfriend's house after barricading himself inside when DEA agent Beasley tried to arrest him. The case was scheduled for trial before Judge Gross last week. The day the trial was to begin, hospital officials, responding to a court order, brought copies of the federally ordered x-rays to court. Pettit, defense attorney Gelber, and prosecutor Phil Maniatti, M-A-N-I-A-T-T-Y, huddled in the jury room with Dr. Robert M. Quenzer of Jackson's radiology department to examine the x-rays. The x-rays showed the top of Pettit's head, but didn't show the neck area behind his ear. Pettit, who was representing himself with Gelber as co-counsel, offered to plead no contest to the arson charge. That arson charge, by the way, interrupting here, was that he was basically charged with having set fire to his girlfriend's house. Pettit, who was representing himself with Gelber as co-counsel, offered to plead no contest to the arson charge and accept a 30-year sentence if another set of x-rays showed nothing. Judge Gross sent Pettit back to the hospital. When Dr. Quenzer returned with the newest tests, he told the judge that something unexplainable is in Pettit's neck. "I thought he was just fabricating a story to beat the charges," said Gross. "The x-rays give me something to think about." "Until the radiologist came in, I thought it was nonsense," said Maniatti. "I don't know what those two things are." The radiologist said it could be metal from an accident, but it's certainly worth checking into. But it has nothing to do with this case. Tuesday, Gross ordered the hospital staff to perform an operation to determine what is in Pettit's neck. Well, there's several things that we should take note of in connection with that story. First of all, the fact that Pettit's attorney, Hamilton, has definitely established that he worked for the CIA is worth taking note of, and as well that his partner, a fellow by the name of Marty, Charles Marty, also worked for the CIA. Now, we've talked at great length on this station, on this and other broadcasts, about the involvement of the CIA and other federal agencies with narcotics trafficking. And Pettit apparently, at least according to his own account, was involved with that traffic, as was his brother. Worth noting that Pettit claims to have found documents about something called Operation Crystal Ball, which he says was a CIA program to control the entire world's political and judicial systems by the year 2000. Now, we have never seen anything about Operation Crystal Ball. We are going to talk about some other CIA mind control programs in this program. Take note also of the fact that the x-rays did establish that there were implants or something in Pettit's neck. And also remember the fact that Pettit suspected that these implants were basically stuck in there in order to get him to commit an assassination, because the use of mind control in order to get people to commit assassinations is something that we're going to talk about at great length on this broadcast. And the article I just read you is not the end of the Pettit story.
Okay, actually, as was mentioned at the end of that last article, James Pettit was taken in for surgery. There was a period of some time elapsed between the initial Pettit story and the surgery coming up. And of course, when we read the original story, a lot of the listeners here on KFJC were rather interested to find out what would happen, since these things so seldom are actually brought to any kind of confrontation. Anyway, here's the follow-up story. All right. This is also from the Miami Herald for June 9th, 1984. Credit for this also to Ted Rubenstein. Headline is X-ray surgery failed to find bug in man. Now, listen to the story, though, and it sounds a little bit different than the headline would suggest. It's by Bill Looning, who's a Herald staff writer. The first CIA operation in Jackson Memorial Hospital history ended in disappointment Friday for James Pettit. It was just after 10 a.m. when Pettit, age 39, convicted drug pilot, accused arsonist, and firm believer that the Central Intelligence Agency has planted electronic thought control devices in his skull, rolled into Ward D at Jackson in a wheelchair and leg irons. He was clutching a court order for the surgery that would prove his claim, ease his mind, and maybe cut his prison time. Quote, "I'm not going to let them put me to sleep," he said wearily. "Jackson's a damn government hospital." He needn't have worried. After reviewing new x-rays taken Friday, the Jackson physician scheduled to do exploratory surgery and find out just what was in Pettit's head refused to operate above the neck. Quote, "I'm not touching that head," said Jackson professor of surgery Gerardo Gomez. Skipping on down, it explains that they did take some scar tissue out of his back. Quote, I want those things that look like bottles taken out of my head. Any refusal by Jackson Memorial Hospital to follow this court order constitutes, in my opinion, collusion with the CIA, said Pettit, holding the folded order from Circuit Judge Howard Gross as senior surgical resident Michael Kotler sewed up his back. Quote, tell me, doctor, do you work for the CIA? What are you talking about? Gomez said, laughing uneasily, looking confused. I don't work for the government. Okay, skipping on down, down at the end. Quote, I want it known that the doctors at Jackson Memorial Hospital refused to operate on the suspicious area, Pettit said. Quote, Mr. Pettit wants the court order enforced, Gilbert said. He said they would try again in court. Since I took this case, I've had 7 people come to the office asking if I can help them with similar problems, Gilbert said. One said she was John Kennedy's girlfriend and the FBI had put transmitters in her head so she wouldn't get JFK in trouble. Everybody wants to know what those things are in his, meaning Pettit's, head. Okay, so essentially what the story boils down to, and there's a lot of stuff in the middle talking about the scar tissue that they took out of his back. These people, the head surgeon has refused to take the stuff out of the back of his neck. They refused to actually even operate above the above the neck when, in fact, there was a court order to that effect. And that was the only reason he was in the hospital. He was not in the hospital to have scar tissue removed from his back. He was in the hospital for exploratory surgery. Anyway, so the upshot is, it says X-rays, surgery failed to find bug in man is the headline. Well, in fact, the X-rays are what prompted them to be sent into surgery, the fact that there were things shown up on the X-rays. And the surgery was not performed in the area where the things were seen. So this is the way that, if not consciously, that somehow that news is manipulated, because you certainly couldn't tell from the headline what the article was about.
Now, these two articles, the stories of Mr. Mahonsky and Mr. Pettit, are really, as we're going to demonstrate on this and the next broadcast about mind control, merely the tip of the iceberg. Now, the Operation Crystal Ball that was alluded to by Mr. Pettit is not something that we can comment on authoritatively here, because obviously we've never seen the documentation, and as Pettit himself says, he could never prove the Operation Crystal Ball routine. But it is a matter of public record that the CIA, as well as the military, have been involved for quite some time in ongoing projects in order to effect mind control on individual human beings for a number of different purposes. First of all, the CIA itself has had a number of different projects to attempt unsuccessfully to control the human mind. As we're going to prove tonight, those attempts were only too successful. One of them was called Operation Bluebird, and by the way, these all ran into one another. Operation Bluebird, Project Artichoke, and Projects MK Ultra and MK Delta. Now, these projects involved a number of different things, not only experimenting on human beings with various psychoactive drugs, but also the attempt to find, in a sense, the perfect courier. In other words, to use mind control on a military or intelligence courier in such a way as that even if captured and tortured by an enemy, he would not be able to divulge the information he was carrying, because that information was locked away in his mind and could only be brought out by someone who had a series of cues which would unlock the post-hypnotic suggestion to forget the message which he was given under hypnosis. Another major focus of these programs was to get someone to attempt to assassinate someone, not only against their will, but without their subsequent knowledge. And this is going to be a major focus of the broadcast tonight. Now, before we get into a well-documented, albeit very primitive, mind control technique, I think it's worth noting that the techniques we're going to be talking about tonight are quite old. The technique we're going to talk about first, something called R-H-I-C-E-D-O-M, which is something we're going to detail in just a second, has basically been in existence. It was fully operational by the mid-1960s. It's worth noting, too, that someone we're going to talk about in the second broadcast, one of these CIA mind control couriers, a woman named Candy Jones, in a letter to a former British intelligence operative named William Stevenson, well known by his intelligence nickname of Intrepid, was informed by Stevenson that he had used such couriers, such zombie couriers as Candy Jones was, in British intelligence in the Second World War. Okay, so these techniques go, in an operational sense, go back that far, because the CIA has claimed that it stopped experimenting on these techniques some time ago. And also in the second broadcast, we're going to read part of an interview with a U.S. government assassin who's going to testify that, yes, the experimenting has stopped because it's operational. But the point to really understand here is that these techniques, the techniques that we're going to describe in detail this evening, are old. They've been fully operational probably for a half a century now, at least some of them. We're going to begin, as I said, by taking a look at a technique called R-H-I-C-E-D-O-M. And a description of this technique, and keep in mind now the situation of Mr. Pettit with his implants in his neck that he said were transmitting thoughts to him which were not his own. To describe R-H-I-C-E-D-O-M, we're going to talk about a book called Were We Controlled. Were We Controlled was written by a man who wrote under the pen name of Lincoln Lawrence. Lincoln Lawrence is identified on the back flap as a major network newscaster who's done a lot of writing, has also worked with the Defense Department on a number of different things. And he began investigating mind control in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, Were We Controlled by Lincoln Lawrence was published by University Books in New Hyde Park, New York, and copyrighted 1967. And Mr. Lawrence, in Were We Controlled, defines R-H-I-C-E-D-O-M as follows. He writes, "Behavior control has progressed far beyond your most fearful dreams and certainly beyond the printed information available to you. There are two particularly dreadful procedures which have been developed. Those working and playing with them secretly call them R-H-I-C and E-D-O-M. R-H-I-C stands for Radio Hypnotic Intracerebral Control, E-D-O-M for Electronic Dissolution of Memory." Now, in order to sort of get a little bit of background on how these techniques came to be developed, we're going to talk about a man named Jose Delgado. And Jose Delgado was the pioneer in something called ESB, or electrical stimulation of the brain. And his significance and background we're going to talk about right now.
Okay. Coming up first, and again, this is from Were We Controlled. The article is from the New York Times of Monday, May 17th, that he's leading off with, and once again by Lincoln Lawrence. In the New York Times of Monday, May 17th, 1965, writes Lawrence, there appeared a front-page story with two photographs headlined, quote, "Matador with a Radio Stops Wired Bull." This story graphically detailed the fascinating experiments conducted by Dr. Jose M. R. Delgado in his laboratories at Yale University's School of Medicine and certain field work in Cordova, Spain. These experiments were explained by Times writer John A. Osmondson in these words. Quote, "Afternoon sunlight poured over the high wooden barriers into the ring as the brave bull bore down on the unarmed matador," in quotes, a scientist who had never faced a fighting bull. But the charging animal's horn never reached the man behind the heavy red cape. Moments before that could happen, Dr. Jose M. R. Delgado, the scientist, pressed a button on a small radio transmitter in his hand, and the bull braked to a halt. Then he pressed another button on the transmitter, and the bull obediently turned to the right and trotted away. The bull was obeying commands from his brain that were being called forth by electrical stimulation, by the radio signals of certain regions in which fine wire electrodes had been painlessly implanted the day before. The experiment conducted last year, which at the time the article is written, last year would have been 1964, in Cordova, Spain, was probably the most spectacular demonstration ever performed of the deliberate modification of animal behavior through external control of the brain. Quote, "He has been able to play monkeys and cats, quote, like little electronic toys that yawn, hide, fight, and go to sleep on command." The story continued. Experiments have been conducted on human beings by Dr. Delgado and other scientists, primarily during the treatment of certain types of epilepsy. He has been working in this field for more than 15 years. Techniques that he and other scientists have recently developed have been refined to the point where, he believes, a turning point has been reached in the study of the mind.
Continuing now with Were We Controlled by Lincoln Lawrence. A vital question that would link ESB research at Yale with advanced RHIC was put to Delgado bluntly. Had the control of the brain been attempted on either humans or animals using radio waves alone with no implantation in the skull? A guarded look came into the scientist's eyes. There had been experiments, unquote. That was as much as he would say. On May 6, 1965, in the course of the James Arthur Lecture on the Evolution of the Human Brain at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, Dr. Delgado left his audience with this thought. science has developed a new electrical methodology for the study and control of cerebral function in animals and humans, unquote. In his paper published in Exerta Medica International Congress No. 87, Tokyo, 1965, Professor Delgado, in reference to chronic radio stimulation of the brain, has this to say in his conclusions. Radio stimulations of the brain were applied for 5 seconds once a minute, more than 20,000 times during 14 days, with reliable results and without disturbances of threshold, spontaneous electrical activity, or morphology of neurons. These facts suggest that programmed stimulation of the brain may be carried out perhaps indefinitely. Note that phrase, that programmed stimulations of the brain may be carried out perhaps indefinitely. Returning to where we controlled. Remember those words, programmed stimulations and perhaps indefinitely. As our journey through the structure of the rumor, by the way, is the rumor that mind control was used in the assassination of President Kennedy, as our journey through the structure of the rumor moves into strange byways, they will reassure you we are not dealing here with science fiction. All of this takes us a trifle past treating epileptic symptoms directly on the road that leads to RHIC. The taunting, mocking question that constantly arises when evaluating Dr. Delgado's public announcement of his work is, how recent are these developments? Has he brought us up to date? Wide-eyed, he will tell you he can't imagine, unquote, how ESB could be used as a tool in brainwashing during wartime. But perusal of his work divulges the fact that his efforts have been quietly subsidized by grants from the Office of Naval Research. 2 points here. First of all, the question of how recent are Dr. Delgado's experiments. We're going to deal with that in just a second. And also, the phrase just, the sentence I just read you. But perusal of his work divulges the fact that his efforts have been quietly subsidized by grants from the Office of Naval Research. So that is basically a branch of naval intelligence, and they have been involved with Dr. Delgado. Now, as we're going to see, this is not the only military or intelligence group that was subsidizing Dr. Delgado's ESB work.
All right. The next section we're going to read is from a book called Mind Control by Peter Schrag, S-C-H-R-A-G. This is copyrighted 1978 by Pantheon Books of New York. Before I read that, though, I want to go back to one little segment here from the very first article we read about David Mahonsky, the young man who was shot outside the White House in March of this year, claimed that he had been drugged and essentially mind controlled. This was his claim. And just want to read this one section here. After he disrupted a hearing with claims that President Reagan, the FBI, CIA, and Air Force Intelligence Agency had drugged him. I just wanted to bring that up because, again, purely circumstantial stuff, but it's rather interesting that somebody who is, you know, your basic garden variety of nutcase, you would expect to come up with things like Reagan, the FBI, and the CIA. It is interesting to hear somebody drag Air Force Intelligence out of a hat to accuse of mind control. Anyway, we're going to read a brief segment here out of the book Mind Control by Peter Schrag, and just bear that in mind. Although the practitioners, in this case Mr. Schrag is referring to the practitioners of this kind of experimentation on humans, although the practitioners complain about government controls and interference, they are themselves agents and beneficiaries of the state, both in terms of funds and other forms of support. It was the state, through NIMH and LEAA. NIMH is the National Institute of Mental Health. LEAA is the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, which helped fund Mark Irvin and Sweet's Neuro Research Foundation of Boston. It was the state, through the Public Health Service, the Office of Naval Research, and the U.S. Air Force Aeromedical Research Laboratory, which funded Delgado's work in the 50s and 60s. So, again, it's rather interesting. Not only is the Office of Naval Research, but indeed the Air Force Aeromedical Center turns up as being the people funding that self-same Dr. Delgado, who was the one out stopping the bull with the radio transmitter.
And as Niptuck pointed out very appropriately, if, as the authorities claim, Mr. Mahonsky is merely an ambient psychotic, why would a crazy person focus on the Air Force Intelligence Service as a vehicle for mind control if, as they claim, he was merely rambling incoherently and with no basis in fact? Going back to Mr. Delgado here, again, keep in mind his links with the U.S. Air Force Office of Aeromedical Research and the Office of Naval Research. I'd like to read you a short section from a publication, an alternative news publication that was published in the early 70s called The Realist. It was put out by a fellow by the name of Paul Krasner. And Krasner subsidized the and printed the research of Mae Brussel, whose work we feature on this station. And in the issue of The Realist that came out in the summer of 1974, basically titled, Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped? And it deals with the Simeonese Liberation Army. There's an interesting piece of information here about Dr. Delgado. This is from the Congressional Record. Quote, and Dr. Delgado is speaking here. This is a quote of him, and he has some interesting views. Quote, we need a program of psychosurgery for political control of our society. The purpose is physical control of the mind. Everyone who deviates from the given norm can be surgically mutilated. The individual may think that the most important reality is his own existence, but this is only his personal point of view. This lacks historical perspective. Man does not have the rights to develop his own mind. This kind of liberal orientation has great appeal. We must electrically control the brain. Someday armies and generals will be controlled by electric stimulation of the brain. Dr. Jose Delgado, that from the Congressional Record, number 26, volume 118, February 24th, 1974. Keep in mind the phrase, man does not have the right to develop his own mind. And because Mr. Delgado has some interesting views. I would also note, by the way, that Mae Brussel, who wrote this article, was the first person in the country to hint that, actually to state that mind control was possible. And this early work of hers has been borne out rather dramatically by research, much of which we're going to present you this evening. Keep in mind that phrase again of Delgado's, man does not have the right to develop his own mind, and we must electrically control the brain. That sounds less equivocal than his statements quoted by Lincoln Lawrence.
Yeah, it's especially interesting in light of the fact that this is a man receiving government aid, your tax dollars at work, to practice experimenting on mind control. And this is a man who feels it's evidence of a liberal orientation to think that people's brains should not be electronically controlled for the good of the state. Okay. All right, back to the book, Were We Controlled by Lincoln Lawrence, and a little more information on Dr. Delgado and the Yale Project. Bear in mind that the earlier article from the New York Times published in Were We Controlled suggested that the experiment with a bull had taken place in 1964, according to that article, or a year before the time that that article was written. Anyway, back to Were We Controlled. Perhaps, the author writes, there is a considerable gap of time between what Dr. Delgado and Yale announced today and what progress they have actually made. An amusing sidelight pointing toward this possibility came when a gentle bit of investigative scrutiny was applied to the good doctor's statements. In May of 1965, John Osmondson's excellent New York Times article refers to to Delgado's flamboyant demonstration with the bull as having taken place, quote, last year, 1964, in Cordova, Spain. Although Dr. Delgado modestly avoids emphasizing the Spain episode in conversations at Yale, he nevertheless has a series of large photographic blow-ups of himself and the bull on the wall behind him. If you gaze at the pictures of the experiments on the wall and Dr. Delgado at the desk in 1965, you must notice that in Spain, Dr. Delgado was an athletic and striking black-haired figure of a man who might even have stopped the bull bravely with a sword instead of a radio transmitter. Across the desk from you, supposedly a matter of, quote, months later, sits the distinguished gray-haired scientist of the moment. Why this unseeming skepticism, the author asks? Why this cynical probing and doubting as to whether we are being handed ancient history instead of the real news about ESB, so vital to the understanding of RHIC, and of course ESB, electric stimulation of the brain, and RHC we're going to hear about a little bit more in just a moment.
Okay. Now keep in mind the fact that Dr. Delgado either was lying in his teeth when he said that that the people who reported that Delgado's research had been done in 1964, that is, the experiments with the bull, were either lying in their teeth or else Dr. Delgado went completely gray in 1 year. And keep in mind his equivocal statements about, well, he wasn't sure if radio control alone had been used to control animal behavior. Next, Lawrence presents some historical background as to how far back not only electrical stimulation of the brain, but also some of the root technology of RHIC, radiohypnotic intracerebral control, goes. Returning again to Were We Controlled. Let us compare the doctor's announcements with a paper offered by another equally well-qualified man of science. We refer to the late L.L. Vasiliev, V-A-S-I-L-I-E-V, professor of physiology at the University of Leningrad. We quote from Critical Evaluation of the Hypnogenic Method of the Results Obtained by Its Application, Improved Version of the Hypnogenic Method from Experiments in Mental Suggestion, unquote. It should be noted that we move a little further in the direction of RHIC as hypnotism is introduced into the procedure. Here are excerpts, quote, as a control of the subject's condition when she was outside the laboratory in another set of experiments, a radio setup was used. Not many experiments of this sort were carried out, but the results obtained indicate that the method of using radio signals substantially enhances the experimental possibilities, unquote. The date of this paper and for these experiments was 1934, 31 years before Yale's news, unquote, announcement. In another part of the paper, Professor Vasiliev reports, quote, Tomaszewski, I.F. Tomaszewski, famed Russian physiologist, carried out the first experiments with this subject at a distance of one or two rooms and under conditions where the participant would not know or suspect that she would be experimented with. In other cases, the sender was not in the same house and someone else observed the subject's behavior. Subsequent experiments at considerable distances were successful. One such experiment was carried out in a park at a distance. Mental suggestion to go to sleep was complied with within a minute. Here, over 30 years ago, was primitive RHIC in operation. It is inconceivable that the fraternity of science has not exchanged information, achieved similar breakthroughs, and progressed far past the announced point in this field. What then is RHIC? It is the ultra-sophisticated application of post-hypnotic suggestion, triggered at will by radio transmission. It is a recurring hypnotic state, reinduced automatically at intervals by the same radio control. An individual is placed under hypnosis. This can be done either with his knowledge or without it by use of narcohypnosis, which can be brought into play under many guises. He is then programmed to perform certain actions and maintain certain attitudes upon radio signal. The signal is practiced while he is under hypnosis to teach him, unquote, how to respond. Certain behavior can therefore be played, unquote, to use Dr. Delgado's term, over a period of days or even months. Reintroduction can be instituted by the same procedure to continue the control for an unlimited time. That, in essence, is RHIC. Take note of a couple of things in this passage. First of all, the fact that a person can be hypnotized without their knowledge. If someone can be administered any one of a class of drugs known as the sedative, or any one of several any one of a number of drugs that belong to the sedative hypnotic class of drugs, they can be placed in hypnosis without willingly submitting to the procedure. Now, some people can't be hypnotized at all under normal circumstances, but with the introduction of these drugs, and of course it's relatively easy for a military or intelligence agency to drug someone without their knowledge, anybody can be placed in a state in which they can be hypnotized. And it's worth noting here a couple of things about hypnosis, that a subject who is placed under hypnosis can be basically can have their memory of something erased, and what is known as a post-hypnotic block can be instituted. This basically would prevent the hypnotic subject from remembering the procedures which he was conditioned to perform while under hypnosis. And that's very, very important, that someone can be hypnotized to do something and they can have all memory of that erased by a post-hypnotic block, okay? And we're going to talk about a physiological means for messing up someone's mind and memory in just a second. Now, the means by which radio can be used to reinforce this hypnotic suggestion will be talked about in a second. Basically, we're looking at a cross between a conditioned reflex and a hypnotic suggestion, okay, a post-hypnotic suggestion. So it's really an intersection of several different psychological techniques and involves several different physiological and technological instrumentalities as well.
Okay, now bear in mind, too, as we've mentioned a couple of times, that that most of this information, most of this material, and apparently, as far as we can tell, the state of art in most of these things was pretty old hat in 1967, 65, 69, when a lot of these books that we're working from were written. The CIA themselves claimed to have stopped mind control operations in the late 60s, or in the mid-60s. That's as may be. You can decide for yourself whether you trust the CIA's word about that sort of thing. However, so we're talking about, at very best, we're talking about a technology that was already old hat 20 years ago. And you can extrapolate based on your knowledge of other types of medical and electronic technologies. Anyway, back to the book, Were We Controlled? And we're going to find out the companion term, RHIC, and get that defined a little better. And Lawrence writes as follows. To our index of terms, add one more, EDOM. EDOM refers to electronic dissolution of memory. If that term causes you to sigh weakly and lean backward toward your shelf of science fiction, we refer you to the Berkeley meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1965. There, EDOM surfaced for just long enough to be noticed. At that meeting, Professor J. Anthony Deutsch of New York University probably didn't realize he provided pioneer public substantiation of an important segment of the EDOM theory, but he did. Before we consider what his speech implied, let us define roughly what EDOM is. The sub rosa work in this field by the same men who developed RHIC is fraught with implication of space-age weaponry. To put it quite simply, EDOM enables man to juggle with other men's sense of time. It provides illusionary distortion of memory that destroys time orientation. For the execution of a crime, and in parentheses, the author's written, like the one in Dallas, which, because that is the theme that threads this book together, or the execution of an organized warfare tactic, EDOM offers unbelievable new powers. How does it work? Well, let's do a bit of homework. The basis of stored memory is the presence of a neutral transmitter substance, acetylcholine. That's spelled A-C-E-T-Y-L-C-H-O-L-I-N-E. At a synapse, which separates one nerve cell from another. EDOM, through the use of radio waves and ultrasonic signal tones, suddenly builds up an excess of the transmitter substance so that it cannot transfer excitation from one cell to another. It, in effect, blocks memory of the moment, which is our feeling of momentary time. It stops time for as long as it is placed in use. EDOM could therefore be used for, let us say, a period of several minutes to make someone skip over those minutes without being aware of the passage of time. Nice toy. We will see how it may have been brought into play a little later on. Professor Deutsch, in addressing the Berkeley meeting of the AAAS, described his work in this field, apparently with no awareness of its connection to EDOM. In a report entitled Anti-Choline Stearase and Dissolution of Memory, he notes, quote, too much transmitter, like too many cars on a highway, causes a jam and so stops transmission. An excess of acetylcholine stops transmission across the synapse, unquote. In his report, Dr. Deutsch describes the loss of memory due to the administration of a drug which raises acetylcholine levels. But according to the rumor, which again is the thread of the JFK assassination that he's following, according to the rumor, the developers of EDOM have managed to go a step further and stimulate the production of acetylcholine not by drugs, but by radio waves.